Hi, this is Monty Lewis, and thank you for listening to this audio program on the 7 keys to a high-performance sales organization. Since 1992, I've been working with sales organizations around the country, and over the years, I've identified 7 areas where the best sales organizations have really excelled. I've worked with sales organizations with as many as 2,500 salespeople, and with companies with as little as 10 or 12 salespeople. And when I say the best organizations, I mean those companies that are normally noted as best in their industry, where customer satisfaction is high, where market share and profitability are higher, and where employee retention is high. And these 7 areas don't even include stuff like sales training or complicated compensation strategies or investments in technology. These 7 areas are fairly simple. Really, there's no rocket science here. Now, I use these 7 areas as a template when I work with sales organizations to compare them with the ideal. And not even the very best get top scores in all the 7 areas. Now, as we go through the 7 areas, consider how your sales organization is doing. Give yourself a score of 1 to 10 for each of these 7 as I describe them. Okay. The first key is launch with a holistic mission. Top sales organizations have a mission that's uplifting, inspiring, and motivating. And by mission, I mean a set of core values, a guiding business philosophy, or a vision statement. Even if you already have a mission, then the question to ask is, how well are you communicating that mission? How are you doing in making your mission a reality? Making it alive and real for your sales organization. Do they feel as though the work they do is making a difference in their world? To explore this more fully, let's take a quick look at a classic management model, Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. Abraham Maslow's hierarchy is represented by a triangle sliced into 5 different strata, with the bottom layer being the survival need, the food, shelter, clothing need. The next level from the bottom is the security need. Fortunately, these 2 basic levels are taken care of for most of our workers. Good companies look beyond these 2 basic needs and want their employees to move up the pyramid to the next 3 levels. Starting with the 3rd level, the belonging need, companies have an opportunity to make employees feel as though they are part of something bigger than themselves. A powerful mission can enrich the lives of your workers by connecting the work they do with something bigger, something greater. And if they do a good job with that, then we have an opportunity to give them a sense of respect. The next level on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If they do a good job of fulfilling the mission, then we have an opportunity to pat them on the back, say thank you for a job well done, or recognize them in front of their peers, and generally fulfill their desire for respect and appreciation. And this means a lot to people. Yes, people will be cynical and say it's all about the paycheck, but deep down, people just want to be appreciated and want your respect and the respect of their peers. The top of Maslow's hierarchy is self-actualization, becoming all that you're capable of becoming. And how we get that is we feel a sense of personal growth. We feel challenged to grow, to become more effective, more successful. And as bosses, we set high stretch goals and give employees the freedom and the support they need to become greater workers. And all this can be achieved by a holistic mission that is well communicated throughout your sales organization. All right, number 2. The next key to a high-performing sales organization is careful recruiting and selection. A great manager needs to have great people. It all starts with your people on your team. I know some of your people you inherited and some you've selected, so make sure you're extra careful in your selection process. What we find is that human resource mistakes are the hardest ones to undo. Select in haste and repent in leisure is a lesson many of us have learned the hard way. When we look at our prospective sales team members, one way to look at them is through the knowledge, skills, attitude development model. Unfortunately, when hiring, we mostly look at the candidate's knowledge and skills. Can you do the job? Have you done the job in the past? So we tend to hire for knowledge and skills, but we tend to fire for attitude. The candidate looked good on paper and on the resume, but then they didn't work well with others, or they didn't get along with their boss, or didn't have the right work ethic. We hire for knowledge and skills, and we fire for attitude. So what many sales organizations are doing now is hiring for attitude. We can train people on attitude, but it is a lot easier if they already have the right attitude when they start work. And what we mean by attitude is typically considered the values dimensions: workplace ethics, trust and integrity, values diversity, and develops positive relationships. Now, a quick tip for hiring that keeps your options open is the rule of three. Make sure you look at least three candidates for each position. Make sure you interview your favorite candidate in three different venues, and have at least two other people, in addition to yourself, interview the final applicant. Sometimes the candidate looks good at the first interview, but then it goes all downhill from there. Now, the question we should always be asking is, does this candidate raise the average of my team? In intellect, in skill sets, in attitude, does this person raise or do they lower the average of my team? Now, the candidates that tend out to work the best are the ones that have chosen to be there. If you can, try to allow your candidate to self-select. At the end of your offer interview, say something like, "Hey, I want to go over the job requirements with you just one more time. The responsibilities and the reporting structure and the performance expectations. Now, I think you could really do well here. Now, don't answer me right now. I want you to think about it overnight or over the weekend, and then give me a call and let me know what you've decided." Now, assuming that you've been clear about the job, when they call, they should say, "I've decided to take the job." They have self-selected. And later on, when the work is much harder than they thought it was going to be, you can always say, "Hey, you chose this job. I didn't hire you. You chose this job." Okay, the third key to a high-performing sales organization is to establish clear performance expectations. People want to know exactly what the job entails. Great sales organizations help their sales team understand exactly what their output and their behavioral responsibilities are. Whether it's client meetings or outbound phone work or the volume of business or the mix of products, top sales organizations are clear about their performance expectations, and they help the sales teams with planning. So the sales teams can plan out their year, plan out their quarters, plan out their months, plan out their weeks. And then they track their actual performance against their plans, and they give feedback on how close they are to achieving a plan. They say, "What gets measured gets done." Now, I want to make a distinction between two parts of performance expectations. There's on the one side the key result areas, which are the measurable outcomes. And on the other side are the standards of performance, which are the manner in which we go about conducting our business. You know, Einstein once said, "Some things that count are more difficult to be counted." Sometimes it's more obtuse. Sometimes it's more of a feeling or an impression that can make all the difference. You can apply some measuring techniques, such as mystery shoppers or customer satisfaction surveys, but the standards of performance are really much more difficult to measure. So now, when you look at performance expectations, consider not just the measurable outcomes, not just the things we do, but consider also how we do them. This approach often makes a difference between a good sales organization and a great sales organization. We've all had mediocre consumer experiences where it seems like the salesperson is just going through the motions and it ruins the entire experience. And we've also had positive experiences where the approach and the delivery was given as much consideration as the product itself. A good restaurant doesn't just deliver your food, but they make a presentation and they turn it into a fine dining experience. So, when we set performance expectations with our sales team, make sure we talk about not just our goals, but our client experiences, not just the quantity, but the quality, in order to separate ourselves from our competition. Okay, the fourth key is to develop a sales team. I've worked with a number of sales organizations in helping them to develop effective sales teams, and I've found that there is a tremendous energy and power when you get your people to work together to produce results together. Real sales teams that come together create passion and energy and enthusiasm that is just hard to replicate when they're working on their own. And besides, it's a lot of fun. There's like an untapped power when putting people together that's just amazing. Let me tell you, they will underperform for you, they will underperform for themselves, but they have a hard time underperforming for their colleagues, for their teammates. They won't let their peers down. Now, the sports world provides a nice analogy, a nice metaphor for business teams. Now, I believe there are two kinds of sports teams. Some teams are really just a number of individual performers working side by side. For example, my daughter is on her high school swim team, and in the most of the heats, there are a bunch of individual swimmers competing against each other. If she wins her heat, then she wins points for her team. At the end of the meet, the school with the most points wins. But essentially, it's just a group of individual performers. Other sports teams like this are the golf team, the tennis team, wrestling, track and field, gymnastics, essentially individual performers just representing the same team. Now, the other kind of sports team, what I call real teams, have a group of people with different capabilities all working together for a shared common goal. For example, in baseball, there are pitchers, catchers, and fielders, infield and outfield, different skill sets coming together to win the game. It's the same with football, soccer, and basketball, each one with different roles, but all the same goal. Now, in the world of work, we call the first kind of team work groups, and the second kind, real teams. So work groups are where you have a number of workers doing the same job, working side by side. And a lot of sales organizations look like that. Their sales teams are essentially individual performers working side by side. Yes, we want them to work well together, to share ideas and learn from each other, but essentially, if the individual wins their heat, then they contribute to our team winning the meet. And real teams are where we have different people coming from different disciplines working together to achieve a common goal. We may have someone that is traditionally from field sales, along with someone from customer service, along with someone from finance or operations or R&D, and they all come together and they set common goals, such as accounts opened or products sold or clients served, and each of them has their role in how to achieve these common goals. So the definition of a real team is a small group of people with complementary skills that have a shared common goal. Let's review that definition. First, a small group. I think this is real important. One boss once suggested that the entire company was one big team. Now, this is a nice idea, and what he meant was that he wanted to encourage teamwork across the entire company. But in order for a team to be successful, it needs to be a small group. How small? Well, that depends really. But I'll take a cue from sports teams again. Baseball has 9, basketball has 5 on the court. So I think between 5 and 9 ought to work. And the team they're on, it needs to be consistent. So the players get to know each other and how to work well together. Don't change them up every month or every quarter or even every year. Okay, complementary skills. This is easiest when they are from different departments. But even when they come from the same discipline, divide up their roles and their responsibilities. Try to match their natural skill sets and their inclinations. You're better at cold calling and new business development. You're better at presentations. You work better with the technical people. And so you should assign them different roles to achieve the common goal. And the shared common goal? Well, even on sports teams, we keep track of individual performance. We know their stats. We know how many RBIs or assists or sacks or yards run or points scored. But the goal is for the team to win. The team to win the game or go to the pennant or the playoffs or the World Cup. The individual performer is important. We know their stats by flipping over to the other side of the baseball card, but that individual card is much more valuable if the whole team makes it to the pennant. So even if you have a group of individual performers, the power of teamwork is really amazing. So consider setting team goals as well as individual performer goals. All right, so why is it that teams outperform individuals working side by side? There's 4 reasons. First, teams bring together people that have different skill sets. I can combine my unique area of excellence and focus only where I'm strong, and I can combine with your special talent, and then your special talent, and your special talent, and none of us has to spend too much time working in the areas where we're really deficient. Essentially, teams focus on strengths. Number 2 reason is teams establish communications that support problem solving. There's always going to be problems and communication breakdowns, but teams have a built-in mechanism and protocol that facilitates solution orientation and problem solving. Teams essentially create a safe environment to solve issues. For example, you might say, hey, I'm going to bring up this problem at our next team meeting. Number 3 reason that teams work is behavioral change, that is, learning new ideas, happens easier in a team environment. People work together to try out new ideas or new practices. So if you're introducing a new way to do business or a new product or service or a new application, the best way to get them to learn something new is to learn it as a team. Because, well, maybe you understand this part and I understand that part, and then when we get back to our desks, we can help each other out and teach each other. When we learn together in a team context, we're more likely to access each other later on when we need help. And finally, number four, teams have fun. As a byproduct of people coming together, working on shared common goals, teams have fun. And fun, it makes us more productive, and it helps us develop the resilience necessary for operating in today's tension-filled times. So, we all agree that teams outproduce individual performers, and we understand the nature of teams by experiencing them in our non-work lives. So why is it that in the world of work, we resist getting involved with teams? Okay, three reasons here. Number one reason that people resist teams is that it involves personal risk. You have to put yourself out there and risk that your success is now intertwined with the performance and the work ethic of a couple of your colleagues. Number two reason that people resist teams is that many feel it's just another one of those management fads. So they give it lip service, but they really hold back on their commitment to the team concept. And without real commitment, it's doomed from the start. And the third reason people resist teams at work is that in some highly matrixed companies, it's really tough to make a connection between the work that the team does and the overall success of the company. If there is a weak organizational performance ethic or there is an unclear mission, then there's going to be resistance in getting involved with teams. All right, number five. The number five key to a high-performance sales organization is to create a high-energy environment. This is what top sales organizations do. They create an energy that almost serves as a force field around them that protects them from the downturns in the economy and from competitive pressures. When the sales team has this powerful energy of positive self-expectancy, then they create their own opportunities and competitive responses even in the face of tough economies and fierce competitors. And you can feel it when you work in these organizations. You feel, hey, there is something exciting going on around here, and man, I'd like to work here. And their customers can sense this kind of energy, and their vendors can sense this kind of energy, and anyone who comes into contact with this organization can sense this kind of energy. And only the managers can do this. Yeah, the corporate office sets the tone and tries to foster a corporate culture, but it is effective managers that create this kind of energy. And how the managers do it is they get rid of all the negative stuff. Top managers focus on removing the negative dialogue, the whining, the complaining, the infighting, and the backstabbing so that the natural, positive energy can thrive. You just don't allow for it. You communicate in an effective fashion. You say, hey, that's not the kind of language or behavior that we like to have in our workplace. Let me share a quick story to illustrate this idea. A few years back, I decided to grow a small vegetable garden with my kids out in the backyard. I hadn't done this before, and I thought it'd be a good family experience. So I went and ordered the best seeds from a popular gardening catalog. And I went out, and I turned over the soil in a corner of the yard. And then me and the kids went out there, and we planted the seeds, and then we watered. On the seed package, it said, allow for 4 to 6 weeks before harvesting. So we came back to that corner of the yard about 6 weeks later. And what do you think we saw? That's right, there were weeds. There were weeds everywhere. There were some vegetables, but mostly there were weeds. You see, that's the situation with weeds. Weeds come unbidden. You don't have to plant weeds. You don't have to water weeds. You don't even have to weed weeds. They just come on their own. And so it is with your garden, with your sales organization. If you don't take the time to engage in regular weeding, you'll be literally surrounded by weeds. This is that negative stuff, and the positive energy can only blossom if the negative stuff is rooted out of there. Now, another way to create a high-energy environment is to be cognizant of what we call the nexus. The nexus is the intersection between you, the manager, and your sales team. Whenever you interact with them, whether it is directly or through email or when you leave a voicemail or one-on-one or in group settings, there is this interaction, this nexus between you and your associate. This nexus can be either positive or negative, but it is never neutral. Your associates kind of either walk away from your conversation either feeling terrific and strong and valued, or they won't. Either positive or negative. And your goal, obviously, is to have many more positive interactions than negative ones. Now, all things being equal, your nexus, your interaction, is the control valve on their overall performance. And they pay attention to every word, every deed, every action, and with a look or a glance, you communicate that they are valued and appreciated, or you dismiss them, and you communicate that you wish they would just leave your employ. So be mindful of the nexus. The manager is the one who sets the tempo, creates the energy, and defines the culture of the organization, and it all happens at the nexus. All right, number six, top sales organizations provide effective coaching. They're constantly working with their people, helping them to get better. They work with their sales teams on a regular basis in a proactive fashion, in many cases, as often as once per month. We talked about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. In order to become self-actualized, in order to become all that we are capable of becoming, we need coaching. Even the very best athletes receive coaching on a regular and in a developmental way. Let me take a minute and talk about who needs coaching. One way to look at the skill sets of our people is through the conscious competence diagram. This diagram is set up like a staircase with five steps. And on the very lowest step are the unconscious incompetence. Now, many of the people who come to work for you don't know how to do their job yet. The problem is that some of them don't know that they don't know how to do their job yet. We call these the unconscious incompetence. Of course, this is the good news. The first stage of development is to recognize that you need help. And so they move on to step two, the conscious incompetence. This is the group that recognize their own performance gaps and now is open to learning. So you put them through training or they get one-on-one coaching, and now they move up to step number three, the conscious competence. Now they know what they're doing, but they have to think about it in a linear fashion. They have to mentally walk through the steps before they can take action. Over time, these actions become more second nature and more relaxed, and they've moved on to the fourth step, the unconscious competent. At this level, their performance is more natural and instinctive. When we speak with these employees later and ask them how they did what they did, they shrug their shoulders and they're unable to break down their performance into its component parts. The challenge with this group is that they slip. They slip into bad habits and they find shortcuts. Now, some of these shortcuts are improvements in our process, but many of these shortcuts actually destroy the integrity of the process. As unconscious competent, we should know better. We stopped doing what we used to do when we first got started. And so our coaching work is not just for new workers, but for our experienced people as well, to get them back to basics. Sometimes when working with better performers, you're looking for best practices. These are special nuances, unique approaches, sometimes those shortcuts that are improvements. And you capture those best practices with the intent to codify them and share them with everyone else on your team. Coaching doesn't have to be about finding something wrong or something to fix, but rather it's about giving developmental feedback. Our goal is to get them up to step number five, which is conscious, unconscious competence. This is where they could do the work in their sleep, but they don't. They're fully present and conscious about the work, even though they're natural and instinctive. What does the professional pilot do before the flight takes off? That's right, he or she conducts the pre-flight check. The pilot is conscious about preparation, and the same goes for a surgeon or a professional chef. In fact, this is the distinction between professionals and amateurs. Professionals think through their procedures and make sure everything is ready to go before they begin, and they stick with their process, particularly when they face a crisis or an obstacle. Amateurs attempt to wing it, and then they stray from course at first onset of an obstacle. Finally, number seven, top-performing sales organizations focus on continuous improvement. You may be familiar with the Japanese term Kaizen, which means continuous betterment. The essence of Kaizen is that great achievements at work and in life require incremental improvements each month, each quarter, each year, until eventually you've created a great sales organization or an individual that is totally unstoppable. Top organizations are never satisfied with the status quo. They're always looking for cheaper, better, faster ways of performing.
Remember, success is the journey and not the destination. There's an illustration referred to as the corridor concept. And the corridor concept says that you need to try new ideas and meet new people in order to have rapid improvement. They say that when one door closes, another opens. But you need to be out there in the corridor to see that new door opening. The essence of continuous improvement, then, is action orientation. That you're always trying out new ideas and meeting new people, the source of those new ideas. And action orientation is a result of self-confidence. Self-confident people are more likely to initiate action. People who are not confident tend to hold back. So you want to create a strong sense of self-confidence throughout your sales organization. And self-confidence is fueled by two sources. One is competence. If your team is competent, if they're good at what they do, then they're more likely to take action. And the other source of self-confidence is an environment of trust, where it's okay to make mistakes. When we mess up, are you going to yell, or will they get in trouble, or is it okay and they'll learn from their mistakes, and then they'll move on and we can all try again? If there's not an environment of trust, then we won't feel confident enough to take action. If some of your team is new and not yet competent, then they need a strong environment of trust. And the best organizations have a great environment, plus their people are really good at what they do. As I review these seven areas, give yourself a score of 1 to 10, with 1 being the lowest and 10 being the highest. Okay, first give yourself a score on launch with a holistic mission. Does your mission motivate and inspire? And are you communicating your mission throughout the organization? Now give yourself a score for careful recruiting and selection. Do you hire for knowledge, skills, and attitude? Give yourself a score for establish clear performance expectations. Do you set standards for how they do the work as well as how much of the work they do? Give yourself a score for develop a sales team. Have you tapped into the energy of teams by assigning a small group of people with complementary skills to have a shared common goal? Give yourself a score for create a high energy environment. Have you eliminated the negative stuff and are you conscious of the nexus, the connection point between you and your associates? And give yourself a score for provides effective coaching. Are you providing proactive developmental sessions on a regular basis? And finally, give yourself a score for continuous improvement. Do you foster action orientation by helping your team to become competent and by creating an environment of trust? Now, the area that you have the lowest score in is the area that you should go to work on right away. The area with your lowest score is your bottleneck, your restraint, your limiting step. It holds back your overall performance. If all the others have a higher score, then a slight improvement in your weakest key area will have an immediate and dramatic impact on your overall performance and results. Thank you for listening to this program. Let me know if I can be helpful to you. This is Monty Lewis, and I wish you all the best.